League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
So here we are, time for another On The Record, the fastest growing podcast series of all time.
That's right.
You can listen to it here at On The Record, of course, on Twitter. You can listen to us through Audio Boom's outfits.
Yes.
You can also listen on iTunes, you can listen on Acast, all sorts of places to go.
That's right.
We do it every Tuesday and every Thursday.
Yes.
If you just come across and subscribe to it, and you'll get it as every twice a week, which
That's
is wonderful.
Right.
Now, what you got for us today, Mr.
Well, let me tell you this. Remember Oliver Reed?
I do.
I always thought Oliver Reed was a bit of a fraud, to be honest.
Really?
Because, well,
I never actually met Oliver Reed.
I tell you who did meet him. Remember that guy we've talked about before, old colleague from Sunny Mirror Days, who wrote all them books about crooks and criminals?
Oh, I know the guy.
And we interviewed
him. Wensley Clarkson.
Wensley Clarkson, yeah. So Wensley Clarkson had to go and find him. Mm. So he goes down to his house in Sussex, right, and he knocks on the door, but the door's open.
No.
And he goes in, and a very, very drunken Oliver Reed turns up. But Wensley said in those days, he always seemed to want to appear to be more drunk than he really was.
Yeah.
He used to appear on TV shows. Mm. And deliberately disgrace himself, taking off his trousers, shouting and screaming. Yeah. But then when he got, when they eventually carted him off the set and said, you can't stay here, he would just dust himself down and go home as a normal person.
So you think it was all a bit of an act?
It was all a bit of an act. But anyway.
Maybe the truth was somewhere in between, I suppose.
Well, maybe it was. Or so he actually drank himself to death in Malta during the making of Gladiator.
That's
didn't
right,
he?
Yeah, because they had to sort of computerised the end of the film.
That's right, yeah.
Because he'd already died before he finished shooting.
To include him, yeah. Mm. So I have no doubt he was a big drinker, but I mean, he may have been like some colleagues we know. Mm. Drink an awful lot, but not even appear to be intoxicated, but wanted to appear to be
intoxicated. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that when he was on the rampage with people like Keith Moon, who was a mate of his, and probably Peter O'Toole.
And the other guy, the Irish guy, Wild Geese.
Richard Harris.
Yeah, Richard Harris.
I think when they were all together, it was
pretty bad. But anyway, look what I came across. People sell me books all the time, okay? Yeah. So novelist and filmmaker Andrew Sinclair recalls in his memoirs the intimidating task of entertaining late screen heavyweights Oliver Reed and Orson Welles on the same film set, okay? After funding for the movie they were making just collapsed. He says, I had to spend 14 hours in an Athens restaurant explaining to these two legends why the film wasn't going on, okay?
Yeah.
He said, Orson sat on three chairs. He was that big at the time, right? He needed three chairs.
Unbelievable.
The three chairs apparently were pulled into like a horseshoe.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any...
No arms.
Right. But he had to sit on three chairs.
It must have been awful to be that size. Can you imagine?
Yeah, exactly. He said, Oliver Reed needed two chairs,
right?
He said, but he wasn't huge or anything like that. He was just spread over them because he was incapable through drink.
Maybe they were just very small chairs in Athens.
Maybe very small chairs in Athens.
Yeah.
Athens people aren't big, are they? Greek people, they eat Mediterranean.
I mean, I think it's probably a bit of a sweeping
lots of tomatoes
statement.
And all that sort of bollocks.
What have you got against people eat tomatoes?
Yeah. Anyway, he said, I know for a fact we consumed 22 bottles of red wine because...
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Even by our standards.
Even by our standards,
How many people?
Three.
Mm. So that's seven bottles each.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
And that's over 14 hours, which isn't long. They started at 11 in the morning.
Yeah.
They would have finished at...
14 hours, you say?
Yeah, 2 in the morning.
Well, if you start at 1 in the morning. 1 in the morning. Yeah.
So 11, yeah, that's not bad. 11 o'clock in the morning start, finish at 1 the following morning. Yeah. Not too bad.
I think the difference with me on that particular front would be you'd have to stop drinking wine eventually and start drinking something else.
Yeah, well.
I mean, like move on to gin and tonic
or knows?
Something.
Anyway, he said it was a very tense meeting because they kept veering in their conversation about whether they're going to smash up the fucking restaurant, you know, because the deal had fallen down.
Because presumably they've all now got out of pocket. They've got no fucking money.
No money. Right. So the discussion that Orson Welles and Oliver Reed kept asking each other, shall we smash up the fucking restaurant or shall we smash up this fucking bastard who's not going to give us our money? Yeah. Right. And it kept going from one to the other. You know, Oliver Reed said, smash up the bastard who's not got the money. And then also I said, well, hang on, where will that get us? Mm. He might get some invention. Let's smash up the restaurant instead. Yeah. And it went like that.
It's a very bizarre world, isn't it, the filmmaking world? Because I remember when I got a job, one of my first jobs in journalism was working for this outfit called the Asian Post, right?
Yes.
Now, this was an attempt. This was an
attempt. Did you go to India?
Yeah, I did, yeah. This was an attempt to make there's a very successful magazine in India called India Today.
Right.
Which is based on the whole sort of Time magazine idea, right? It comes out once a week. Yes. Looks exactly like Time magazine.
Yeah.
You know, very tidy columns of print, lovely colour pictures, very nicely put together.
Yes.
Not quite as slick as Time or Newsweek, but pretty good, right?
Okay.
So the idea of this magazine was to put it into all the homes of the Asians living in Britain.
Right.
You know, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Indians.
Yeah.
It's a big number of people.
Right, okay.
And to make it, but it never had the money that India Today had.
Yep.
So it was always a bit of a cut rate thing, right?
Yes.
But also, bizarrely, we came into contact with all kinds of weird people. Mm. Like, for example, Saddam Hussein, at one point, sponsored one of the issues, right? So we had this huge picture of Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
On the cover, yeah.
Sponsored a copy of this magazine?
Well, the Iraqi government did, right?
And so
therefore, you know, we
this
had interviewed...
This must have been way before, like, sort of
this was the mother of all battles
and all
early
that.
80s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
When he'd been put there by the Americans, you know, for all intents and purposes.
That's right,
he was Western friendly.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
He wasn't the guy he saw hanging
from
the fucking...
No, he was there to take out Iran, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
That's right,
and the Ayatollahs and all that, right?
Yeah,
so we had this, like, 16-page special on Saddam Hussein. which included the editor of the magazine. I was like, I became like the production editor. Right? The editor going to Baghdad to get a fucking interview with the mad bastard, right? And he just had to run it all. You know, it was all bollocks, absolute shite. You know, but never would you have ever wanted to read it.
No, sure.
But this was me kind of cutting my teeth on, you know, international journalism.
Yeah.
Anyway, out of nowhere, the magazine, which was started out being owned by. I think it was something like Siraj Paul, you know, who's Lord Paul now. He's one of the Asian...
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
he was a very successful businessman in this country.
He used to own a steel company.
He did.
So it was his idea, and he was quite a moderate guy. Mm. But ended up being bought by this Pakistani shipping magnate called Mahmoud Sipra, right?
Right, okay.
Who ended up getting involved in one of the most corrupt... Yeah. And ridiculously, you know, illegal shipping scandals the world has ever seen.
Right.
He ended up having a warrant after him.
Yeah.
So we had all these kind of weird things going on. But he made a film, bizarrely, with Michael Caine, two or three other quite big names, and a couple of sort of, you know, Hindi actresses.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for a while, we were sort of associated with this film business. And we realised that if you walk into a film sort of set...
Yeah.
And you're with the guy that runs it, who owns it.
Yes.
You get treated like royalty.
Yeah.
And basically, if you turn up with a few million quid, you can make a film.
Right.
And you can get people like Michael Caine to work for you.
Yeah.
It's a very bizarre world.
And did Saddam Hussein have a role in that as well?
Well, no, Saddam Hussein, by this time, we'd moved on from
it. No, I see,
We were just doing a big, you know, but there was a lot of adverts started appearing in the paper for, like, the, you know, the Iraqi National Bank.
Sure.
All this kind of shit.
Unbelievable.
You know? I mean, it's incredible.
In the end, I quite admire Saddam Hussein because...
Really?
Well,
I don't think you want to say that too loudly,
to be honest. I'm not going
to
say it too loudly, but the thing is, he understood what life and politics and rule was all like in the Middle East.
Mm.
So he, like... Gaddafi just mounted a coup, and he knew full well, as a young army officer, he knew full well if he succeeded, he was going to be overall ruler of a big country, and if he failed, he'd get fucking shot.
But he also knew that he had the backing of the CIA, which helped matters
magnificently. Well, yeah, but I mean, he'd been quite clever politically to get all that backing and all that. What I'm saying is, they understand the politics, so if the coup succeeds... Yeah. You're on top, and if it doesn't, you'll probably be crucified. Yeah. But
I mean, it doesn't make it. It's not any accident, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That since the CIA and MI6 stopped running the world, it's all gone to hell.
It's all gone to hell. I totally agree because they're not controlling the balance of power.
Yeah, but it's not our job to run the world. Well, maybe not.
The Arab Spring was the worst thing that ever happened to anybody in this world because it simply meant the world got smashed up, you know, by people like Tony Blair and David Cameron.
Yes.
But just to finish on Saddam Hussein, so He was pretty
Saddam.
Saddam. He was pretty all right until George W. Bush and Tony Blair decided to invade Iraq for no reason, because it wasn't like they'd invaded Kuwait together.
They decided to turn on him, though, didn't they?
They decided to turn him, and they started off by saying, "Oh, weapons of mass destruction."
Have you overlooked the first time he invaded Kuwait, though?
Yeah. Oh no. The first time he invaded Kuwait, it all went right.
Yeah.
George H. Bush then said, "Get the fuck out of Kuwait."
Right.
And when he said, "I don't want to go," all right, we're going to fucking push out. So they did. So anyway, so they went back down the road to Basra, into Iraq, and they just rebuilt Kuwait, and they rebuilt all the oil wells. That wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
So then they said, all right, we'll just leave him. And then, you know, about twice a week, he would mess around by sending planes up to fly across, you know, Kuwait and all that.
And but then they just the no-fly zone.
Yeah, just
yeah, but there was 9/11 that killed him off, because, I mean, I've told you before about the book, you know, by what's his name, Woodstein.
Yes.
Well, it wasn't Woodstein, but it was Bob Woodward.
Yeah.
The guy who did Watergate.
Yeah.
Bob Woodward, who wrote the book called Bush at War.
Yes.
Who said that the immediate aftermath of 9/11, you know, he knows that in a room was George Bush, George W. Bush, and all of his senior advisors, Rumsfeld and all that lot, and he said, "This is Saddam Hussein's fault, and we're going after him."
That's right.
And a couple of people said, "Well, you haven't got any evidence about that." No, and he said, "Never mind, he's responsible, we're going after him."
Yeah, not only that, but...
unfinished business.
He said unfinished business from my daddy.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Exactly.
But George H. Bush was clever, because George H. Bush said, "Get back into Iraq and just stay there."
Yeah.
And somebody said, "Why haven't you invaded Iraq?" He said, "Because who's going to take over? It'll smash up the Middle East. Just let them get back there." George W. Bush, you're quite right. I mean, when they eventually got there, Saddam Hussein said, "Do you know, I hated that bastard. What was the name of the Mick Fleetwood guy?"
Mick Fleetwood?
Yeah, Osama bin Laden, all right?
What's he going to do with Mick Fleetwood?
Well, he looked like Mick Fleetwood, didn't he? No, he did. He did.
Osama bin Laden did not look like Mick Fleetwood.
Osama bin Laden.
Rubbish.
Osama bin Laden was a spitting image of Mick Fleetwood.
Bollocks.
I mean, I've said this before, actually,
Mick
on the day it happened.
Mick Fleetwood's not got black hair.
Mick Fleetwood obviously has nothing to do with terrorism worldwide. But,
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that when he was eventually captured by the Americans.
Maybe he should have done a Fleetwood Mac tribute act in Afghanistan, and maybe they'd never found him.
Maybe. Saddam Hussein said to him, he said, "I don't know why you guys invaded." He said, "I haven't got any weapons of mass destruction, and you know that you haven't found me." He said, "And by the way, I hated that bastard Osama bin Laden."
Yeah.
He said, "If I could have killed him, I would."
Right.
"So I don't know why you invaded." Mm. But when they dragged him out of that hole in the ground, eventually, and said, "Right, we've got you now," he said, "OK, well, let's get it over with then quickly." Yeah. He understood the politics.
Yeah.
"I'm not the leader anymore.
Yeah.
Take me away, shoot me, hang me, whatever you want to do. Let's get on with it."
Yeah.
And that's the way the world works in that part of the world.
It was quite a shocking thing that happened, really.
Yeah.
The fact that they then, on national television, hanged him.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And we had it on, I remember.
Yeah.
We were considering putting it off because I was like, "I'm not sure my kids should be watching this."
Yes, that's right.
As they were putting a noose around his neck.
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
And we were about to push him off the top of a ladder.
But he never, you know what I mean? At his last moment, he never squealed or begged for mercy or anything. He said, "Come on, let's get on with it." Mm. So, you know, that's the way people there live.
No.
Anyway, you're going to tell me now about a book that
talking about the Oliver Reed sort of, you know, crazy days, right? Now, you want to talk about crazy days. You talk about Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Now, a very good friend of ours is a man by the name of Michael Brennan,
top man,
who we've talked about a lot on this podcast.
Top guy,
right? He lives in Costa Rica, has taken some brilliant pictures over the years.
He has.
Of Muhammad Ali, Mike Tyson, almost anybody you can think of who was part of America's
Fleetwood Mac.
He won Fleetwood Mac. Mm. He won, of course, Photographer of the Year for his pictures of Donald Campbell's attempt at Bluebird's world speed record
in the Lake District.
He also, and I only know this because I've already had him give me a massive print, which I gave to my daughter.
Lovely.
He's also was on a plane with Led Zeppelin once. What I didn't know was that not only was he on a plane with Led Zeppelin in the 70s, he was actually on tour with them pretty much for nearly 2 years.
Wow.
On and off, right?
Yeah.
And
a
book has just come out, including his pictures and Terry O'Neill's pictures. Mm. Terry O'Neill, of course, famously the guy who took that incredible picture of Faye Dunaway.
That's right, the day after she won the Oscar.
The Oscar for, what was it for?
Bonnie and Clyde.
Was it for Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah.
Yeah, or was it Chinatown? Anyway, one of the two.
Yeah.
And he ended up staying.
Yes.
Did he not?
He did.
He ended up marrying her, took a picture, he took all her clothes off, God knows what he got up to.
Yeah.
But anyway, here's
what
it says on the back of this book, and it's from ACC Editions.
Yeah.
It's from Iconic Images. Between 1975 and 1977, there is little doubt that Led Zeppelin ruled supreme as the biggest band in the world.
Yeah.
Bigger audiences, bigger stage settings, bigger venues, lights, lasers, dragon suits, all this combined to produce some of the most iconic images of the 1970s rock era.
Mm.
And it's a picture, it's a picture book, but if you look, I mean, if you just look through it, I mean, just look at that. I mean, Robert Plant yeah. who has got more stories to tell of debauchery
yes.
and incredible sort of, you know.
Yes.
That's Peter Grant, the manager, right? He's a big
that's
fat
right.
guy. Now, he's the
we
guy.
We knew Pete, didn't we?
I'd never met him. I don't
I think
know if you
I
did. He's the guy yeah. who used to basically carry gum. He was the first kind of rock and roll music, yeah. Rock and roll sort of manager
yeah. Yeah.
who took no shit from anybody. He
That's
insisted
right.
always on Led Zeppelin being paid in cash.
And do you know they used to carry it round
yeah.
In a huge box.
In a huge box, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was the one that organised everything that they did. And if the money wasn't there when yeah. they got there, he just pulled the gun out, put it to the guy's head, and go,
yeah.
"Well, you better send somebody for the money, or we're yeah. going to fucking shoot you."
Or we're not going on stage.
Or we're not going on stage.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, also
yeah.
incredible kind of incredible pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, stadium shows like that. They were the
yeah.
first band to have their own plane.
Okay, folks, you can't see this, but Mike is showing me this incredible picture of an open-air
Looks
American...
Like Candlestick Park.
Candlestick Park or somewhere like that,
yeah.
but it's utterly fantastic. I'll tell you the story about the money, right?
Yeah.
They used to carry this money around in a... You know the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where
yes.
they're looking for the Ark?
Oh, yeah.
They used to carry it around
yeah, like
in a box
chest.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they used to carry it around. And there were two poles that went, you know, in the top of the box, and they had four people who carried the box around.
Yeah.
And guess what? Halfway through one of the American tours, the box got nicked.
Right.
Somebody stole the box with all the money in it.
Right.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And I remember Peter Grant going completely mad and demanding being repaid again
right.
by the promoters... Who said, well, we gave you the fucking money, mate. It's not our fault. We lost it. He said, it doesn't matter.
Right.
I need it again.
And
we'll never come back.
There's some great pictures in here, not least pictures of all sorts of stadium shows and everything else, but
yeah.
some great quotes as well. They played Tampa Stadium
yeah.
June the 3rd, 1977.
Yeah.
Big picture, great picture of Robert Plant here. He says, we want you to bear with us, folks, because there seems to be some water falling on the electrical equipment.
Mm.
I mean, it was just mad.
Yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
really
yeah.
knew what was going on.
No.
And I always remember when they were the biggest band of all time. They made more noise than the jet engine of a Boeing 737.
Yes.
You know, they were
yes.
measured as, you know, the decibel level was
That's
even
right.
higher than standing next to an aircraft.
They,
and, of course, Jimmy Page,
yeah.
the first protagonist of the double-headed guitar.
Well, the 12-string, yeah.
The, well, not just 12 strings,
yeah.
but two lots of 12 strings.
That's right,
so
yeah.
24 strings.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, it was
Absolutely
amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah. They flew
it's
around
a great book.
In the same Dakota aeroplane that U2 later flew
yes.
around in. And that's the one upon which Mick took a picture of them sitting by the fireside.
Well, it looks like a fireplace,
there,
yeah.
There was a fireplace
yeah,
built
I mean,
into
fake,
the side of the
plane.
It's
a sort of fake fireplace,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, of course it is, but they wanted it there.
And, of course, famously, Ivor Key, our other good mate,
yeah.
on one of the trips certainly was on the plane.
Yeah.
And he got into a fight with John Bonham,
yeah.
the drummer,
yeah.
right, who was a mad, sort of crazy,
he
drunken
was, yeah.
maniac.
Yeah.
And he threatened to throw him off the plane.
Yeah.
Because at one point, Ivor, who was a very sort of, you know, laid-back
Yorkshireman, yeah.
and at some point or other...
Yeah, you Jaff bugger.
But he used to occasionally drop the odd fucking tablet of Valium,
yeah.
which turned him into a bit of a maniac.
Who was that?
Ivor.
Why,
oh, yeah,
why was he taking Valium?
Well, he became addicted to Valium.
When I didn't know that.
Yeah, he
did.
Yeah, yeah. When he was
Good
first, when he first sort of
no,
split up,
Doring divorced.
Well, no,
him.
When he first split up with her, and he was seeing that
yeah.
The other woman.
Oh, the younger
you know,
woman. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who we don't like to talk about.
Yes.
He was apparently under a lot of stress, so he used to pop all these Valium. I think she used to get them for him, right?
Good God.
And he got into a row with John Bonham. And he said, well, listen, mate, I don't give a fuck who you think you are, but as far as I'm concerned, you're just a fucking banjo player.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was what he said to this guy who was making about $5 million
yeah.
a year
yeah, that's right,
drumming
yeah.
for the greatest rock
and
roll band
attracting audiences
of, all time.
Of hundreds of thousands
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
You know why they're called Led Zeppelin?
Yes.
Jimmy Page had been in the Yardbirds, was he?
He was in the Yardbirds.
That's right, yeah. And they got the group together, and Robert Plant, obviously, with the... I don't know who Robert Plant was singing for before, but they met Keith Moon.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Page, it was one of these like coffee bars in Soho.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they were taking more than
probably
coffee.
Probably off Denmark Street.
Yeah,
where all the
Denmark
music
Street.
Publishers
yeah. Something
were.
Like that, yeah. And he said, yeah, we're getting a supergroup together. And Keith Moon considered himself already to be in a supergroup called The Who.
Yeah.
And he said, really? He said, and who's that then? He named it.
Yeah.
He said, you will go down like a lead
balloon. Like a lead
balloon,
yes.
And Jimmy Page thought about this. Lead. So we went back. And he said, not Led Bloom, Led Zeppelin, and then said, and if we want to crack America, we're going to have to take the A out of lead because they'll call us Lead Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And we're not Lead Zeppelin, we're Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
That's how it came
out. I know, brilliant.
Yeah. Utterly brilliant.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
So that's the rock and roll section for this particular week.
Yeah, that's right.
What else you got for us?
Well, let me tell you this, right? If you have a property portfolio...
Have you got a property portfolio?
Yeah,
a
property
portfolio. Hey, by the way, I've got to ask you this, because people have been asking me for occasional updates on, you know, your lifestyle that people like to follow.
Yes.
Have you now got the new Rolex?
Yes.
Have you?
Yes.
So you've paid for it?
Yes.
You've had it valued?
I've had it fitted.
Fitted? Valued. Well, what do you mean? All you've got to do is put it on your arm.
No, no, no.
Valued, what do you mean fitted? What does that mean?
You have to have it fitted so that the links in the bracelet are suitable to your wrist.
Oh, yeah.
And not only the links, but the strength of the springs between each link.
Really?
Because they're made of silver and gold.
Oh, I see.
And
well, how much did you pay for the extra fitting, then?
The fitting was about £800.
What?
Yes.
What, so that you can actually wear the bloody thing?
Yes.
£800?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
It's got two clips on it. It's got
my
a main clip.
My watch is only worth about £200.
Yeah, I know. It's got a main clip and a safety clip.
Well, why aren't you wearing it, then?
Well, because I only wear it on special occasions, you know.
Right, so when will you wear it next?
I mean, well, not
you
working
be
with you, because that's not a special occasion.
It certainly
you know what
isn't.
I mean?
No, not for you, it's not. No. No, neither
no,
for me.
No,
but the
no.
problem is, right, if you wear it in London, you've got a pretty good chance of your arm being hacked
could
off.
Could be, could be.
There's a guy in Shepherd's Bush a few weeks back, right, he was taking his kids to school.
Yes.
And he's holding his boy's hand.
Yes.
And these two horrible robbers came up to him and said, you don't give us your watch, we're going to cut your arm off.
That's right, yeah.
Not, you don't want that, do you?
Not a good choice.
No.
And, of course, Simon, our good friend, Simon, what's his name?
Simon who?
You know, Simon used to own Crystal Palace.
Simon Jordan.
Simon Jordan, of course.
Your good friend.
He got raided for a £100,000 watch, so that's not good. But, no, what I was going to say to you was, if you ever come across knotweed, you're dead.
Knotweed?
Knotweed.
This is the Japanese
stuff. Knotweed.
Now, when you say come across it, do you mean come into contact with it? Breathe in the spores?
No, no.
What do you mean?
It's not injurious or dangerous to human health.
Uh-huh.
It is very injurious and dangerous to property.
What do you mean?
I have read a report...
I couldn't care less about your property.
...in one of my property manuals of a family in somewhere like Northamptonshire who bought a...
Shakespeare country.
No, that's Warwickshire, you idiot.
It's near there, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Isn't
it's nowhere
it?
Fucking
sure?
near there. Northamptonshire's famous
You're
for
telling
the,
me that Shakespeare never went to Northamptonshire?
Never went to Northamptonshire. Right. Never in his life.
All right.
Warwickshire.
I've been to Silverstone.
Yeah, well, Silverstone's
I did a rally driving course there.
Did you? Yeah.
It was really good. I was really good at it.
It must be a strong car to get your fucking big body.
Well, actually, funnily enough, you say that, it was actually a Ford Escort. Which used to be the best rally cars of all time. Because they had a huge engine.
My mate had one.
It was a Cosworth, right?
Yeah.
And it had the cage.
Oh,
and
I got in the
thing and I drove it with a crash helmet on the whole thing. And there's nothing like driving in a straight line towards a wall at 90 miles an hour, knowing that you're going to make a handbrake turn.
That's right.
And suddenly go left.
Come back, yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting indeed, So I read about this. They built these houses in Northamptonshire near to a railway line.
Uh-huh.
And that's not unusual because space is running out in this country. And in fact, I own a property which backs onto a railway line.
Oh, yeah, where's that?
In Carshalton, in Surrey.
Carshalton?
Yes, that's right.
Oh,
yeah,
so
yeah,
not the one you live in Surrey?
No.
There's
no.
another place.
This is a townhouse.
Oh, who lives in that?
At the moment, I think it's a bloke who sells buckets on the front of JCB diggers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he does very well.
And where does he keep those?
Well, he doesn't keep him at the house, obviously. You know, he's got a builder's yard somewhere and all that kind of stuff.
So
you know.
He rents this place from you, does he? Well, a town, whole townhouse.
Yes.
How much do you charge for that?
I think it's about $1,350 a month.
Really?
Or something.
Yeah, that's
something
quite like reasonable for a whole house.
Well, yes, it's not bad.
I pay that just for a flat.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
but that's in London, I suppose. Yeah. This is a bit further out.
This is a bit of a shithole.
Yeah. I think it's 1,350. It might be 1,500.
You don't even know how much you're charging.
Well, it's all looked after. It's all looked after. Anyway.
This is another house I didn't know about.
No.
Yeah, it is. This is in addition to the Egyptian Doctor, in addition to Orwell Quay, in addition to Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, i.e. Sutton, in addition to Gosport, right?
No.
So this is now five houses.
No.
It's
we
five.
Must get into that. It's a portfolio. It's a portfolio.
Well, that's a minimum of five.
Anyway, listen. So, what I'm saying is that this poor lady, I've seen a study in case, has moved into a new house. She loves it. It's a semi-detached.
Semi.
Yeah, it's like two or three bedroom little house and all that. Yeah. Still very expensive. Even there, probably costs about $350,000 or something.
Really? In Northamptonshire?
Yeah. Because it's, you know, it's maybe
$250,000.
Maybe $275,000, something like that. Or something, you know.
Yeah.
And then she notices this plant coming over the fence at the back, you know.
Right.
So she thinks, I wonder who owns that land behind us, because I want that cut down.
Mm.
So she makes some inquiries. It's owned by Network Rail.
So this is not the other side of the detached, the semi-detached house. This is beyond there.
It's beyond there. It's off their back garden.
Ah, OK.
The back garden.
The railway, yeah, because the railway owns the property on either side of the railway, doesn't it?
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. Mm. So she rings up and she goes to Land Registry.
Can you imagine trying to get a nightmarish phone call through to Network Rail?
Well, hang on, she goes to Land Registry first, who owns it? Oh, it's Network Rail. Yeah. No, actually, they are huge. Network Rail's property division, or what you call their land maintenance division, is massive.
Yeah, but can you imagine trying to get through to somebody?
They own almost as much property as the Church of England, who are the biggest landowners in this country. Yeah. Did you know that?
Right.
Yeah.
I thought the Duke of Westminster was.
Well, he's very big, but the Church of England owns more.
Yeah.
So eventually she gets through to the right person and says, can you... No, it's not a responsibility. You know, well, it must be if it's your land. Yeah, but there's no easement on the land to say we have to curtail the growing on...
It's just running wild, presumably, this land.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, she then finds out it's Japanese knotweed.
Right.
Do you know how she finds out?
How?
Because all of a sudden, the patio in her house starts lifting.
Oh, well, the knotweed's coming up from underneath.
The knotweed's coming up from underneath.
Oi.
So this knotweed is not just coming over the fence, it's coming into the house. Mm. I mean, this is like Day of the Triffid stuff.
Really?
I'm not joking. Yeah.
No.
Within
weeks...
Well,
they can't come in the house, surely.
Within weeks, it's taking up the garden, it's coming through the door, it's Day of the Triffid stuff, I'm telling you, honestly. And, you know, she's got out a blowtorch, started burning it and all that.
Blowtorch?
Yeah.
Why don't you just use a bit of weed killer?
Weed killer won't kill Japanese knotweed.
Well, where's it coming from?
It's coming from the embankment.
No, I don't know that, but I mean, how did it get there?
Well, nobody knows. It was imported in this country in the last century.
What and it's really imported. Who imports knotweed?
Well, nobody imports it, but it's the same
spores.
Spores, that's right.
They don't blow all the way here from Japan.
No, but when you bring boatloads of sushi from Japan, there is stuff on Japanese boats which suddenly land at ports with places like that, and then the spores blow all over the place.
That's a load of fucking rubbish.
No, it's not. It's
not.
I'm
sorry, I'm not buying
it. It's not. Let me tell you this.
No, go on.
The River Dee was the most... is the busiest port. Chester on the River Dee was the biggest port in the world in Roman times.
Yeah.
And then guess what happened?
The Romans moved back to Rome.
No. What happened was that some idiot from Venetia came sailing up the River Dee on his boat.
Uh-huh. And, was it Phoenicia?
No. Venetia. Yeah. And threw some stuff over side into the River Dee.
Oh, yeah.
And that started a growth of grass at a place called Park Gate, which is on the entrance to the River Dee, which has never stopped growing for 2,000 years.
And how fast is it growing now?
Well, it's land. It's now land.
Land?
It's land.
Okay.
It's land.
Well, he's done you a favour then.
No,
he's
no.
reorganised the water scenario.
No, the River Dee used to be the world's most busiest river.
Rubbish.
And this bastard from Venetia, you know, like some sort of trader from Turkey or something like that, you know, he threw a load of stuff in the river.
But what did he throw? Seeds?
Well, nobody knows. It was a long time ago.
Right.
And all this grass started growing, and it completely took over the estuary.
Right.
So imagine, for instance, imagine Bala Lake.
Well,
right.
Do you know what I saw a picture of?
What?
Because when the guys were all out in Russia for the World Cup, lots of people were putting pictures up. All sorts of people, not just from Talk Sport and Talk Radio, and, you know, BBC and all that.
Yeah.
But there was somebody who put up a picture of the Volga. Right,
Volga,
the Volga, which I presume is in Volgograd.
The Volga is the longest river in Europe.
Well, not only longest, but it's also the widest, because they showed this picture of the Volga River, and all you could see was a mass of water, right?
Yes.
But in the far distance, you could see another big mass of land.
Yes.
But the mass of land you could see was not the other side of the river.
No.
It was a bloody island in the middle of the river, which tells you how wide the river is.
There's about a mile wide. Only one river in the world wider.
Oh yeah.
The River Plate.
In Argentina.
And the only other one that's wider...
What about the Nile?
The St. Lawrence. No, the Nile's not wide. The Nile's not that wide.
Are you sure?
St. Lawrence is in Canada. Uh-huh. That's a very wide estuary.
Yeah. Yeah.
The River Plate's a very wide estuary.
What about the Rhine?
No, the Rhine's not a wide river.
No?
No.
Are you sure?
If the Rhine was a wide river...
Thames estuary's pretty wide.
What?
Thames estuary's pretty wide when you get down to Dartford.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty wide, the estuary, but it's not the biggest in the world by any means
I'm not saying it is. But the River Bloody Dee is not either.
No, it used to be, and all this grass growing there.
No.
Now, let me tell you this.
Yeah.
If the Rhine was a wide river, we'd never have conquered Germany in 1944.
Huh?
Because it was only because the Rhine's not a wide river we managed to get it because they built all the bridges, you see.
Yeah.
And the Royal Engineers had to go into the water and rebuild the bridges to get all our armaments over because we were coming from the west while the old Ruskies, the commies, were coming from the east.
They were on our side, I'm going to remind you.
Well, were they?
Yeah, well, of course they were.
Were they?
Yes, they were.
No, I think
if it wasn't for the Russians, actually, we would never have won the war.
No, if it wasn't for the fact that Hitler tried to take on the Russians, we wouldn't have won the war.
Well, exactly.
If he'd have concentrated on Western Europe, it would have been all over.
Exactly. So, therefore, if it wasn't for the Russians, we would not have won
very
the war.
Brave people, the Russians. And, you know, Stalingrad, 1.8 million people died in the battle. Well, that might have been Leningrad, but there were two big battles in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, they were really fighting not just the Russians, they were fighting the weather as well. Because if you remember your history, you'll remember that the German petrol tanks all froze.
That's right.
All the gasoline froze.
Everything froze.
They couldn't move any of the trucks because of the snow.
Everything
froze.
And
people were dying in the terribly cold conditions.
It was.
And so the Russians didn't actually have to do anything.
No,
they just had to lead them in to the Siberian winter.
Well, Napoleon,
and that was the end of them.
Napoleon fell the same way. He tried to invade Moscow.
Well, Napoleon.
No, exactly the same thing happened to Napoleon. The Russian winter got him. Now, the difference is that,
he didn't
of
have
course,
any petrol.
Well, he didn't need petrol because he had horses, but he had nothing to feed
petrol.
Them on. He had nothing to feed them on. Now, the Germans, they're absolutely right in everything you've said, but in addition to that, remember that an army marches on its stomach, and if you can't get your supplies up to the front, which they couldn't, because either the
nothing
vehicles... Nothing to eat.
No.
So they all starved to death. They all literally starved
to
death. And do you know what? There's a very, very poignant and sad documentary I've seen of the Second World War.
Yeah.
Where these German boys are lying in a gun shelter with their guns in their hands.
Yeah.
They are freezing to death and eventually freeze to death.
Yeah.
And the only thing they've got to comfort them about their home is one cracked record of Lily Marlene playing on a it's so touching and so poignant.
Uh-huh.
And these boys are 19. It was Hitler's last throw, and he sent, you know, the youth regiments into Europe.
Yeah.
And they all froze to death, and you can see it edged on their face. But they froze to death to the strains of the German equivalent of, you know... the
we'll meet
blue
again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Lily Marlene.
Yeah.
It's so terrible.
There you go.
War is terrible.
War is terrible. We are the two mics. And, of course, famously, Ivor Key, our other good mate, on one of the trips, certainly was on the plane.
Yeah.
And he got into a fight with John Bonham, the drummer, right, who was a mad, sort of crazy,
drunken maniac. Yeah.
And he threatened to throw him off the plane.
Yeah.
Because at one point, Ivor, who was a very sort of, you know, laid-back Yorkshireman, and at some point or other...
But
he used to occasionally drop the odd fucking tablet of Valium, which turned him into a bit of a maniac.
Who was that? Ivor? Why was he taking Valium?
Well, he became addicted to Valium.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. When he was first,
Doreen divorced him.
Well, no, when he first split up with her, and he was seeing that the other woman.
Oh, the younger woman. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who we don't like to talk about.
Yes.
He was apparently under a lot of stress, so he used to pop all these Valiums. I think she used to get them for him, right?
Good God.
And he got into a row with John Bonham. And he said, well, listen, mate, I don't give a fuck who you think you are, but as far as I'm concerned, you're just a fucking banjo player.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was what he said to this guy who was making about $5 million a year drumming for the greatest rock and roll band
of all
time.
Attracting audiences of hundreds of thousands and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
I mean, when they eventually got there, Saddam Hussein said, do you know, I didn't eat... I hated that bastard... what was the name of the McFleetwood guy?
Mick Fleetwood?
Yeah,
Osama
bin Laden, all right?
What's he going to do with Mick Fleetwood?
Well, he looked like Mick Fleetwood, didn't he? No, he did.
Osama bin Laden did not look like
he
Mick
did.
Fleetwood.
Osama bin Laden...
Rubbish.
Osama bin Laden was a spitting image of Mick Fleetwood.
Bollocks.
I mean, I've said this before, actually,
Mick
on the day it
happened. Mick Fleetwood's not got black hair
Mick Fleetwood obviously has nothing to do with terrorism worldwide, but...
Well, I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that when he was eventually captured by the Americans...
Maybe he should have done a Fleetwood Mac tribute act in Afghanistan, and maybe they'd never have found him.
Maybe. There is stuff on Japanese boats which suddenly land at ports with places like that, and then the spores blow all over the place.
That's a load of fucking rubbish.
No, it's not.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.